So this is the third time that I've been here over this past summer, which is slowly fading on us. And I don't know if you remember, but the previous two times there had been, in the immediate day or so before, some violent tragedy. I was trying to think, it's so heartbreaking. I had to think, well, which ones was it? Because we're bombarded, there is so much of this kind of thing in the world. I think it was the bombings in Paris and then the Orlando shootings. And as I was preparing to come, I thought, oh, I hope there's nothing today. And then I realized there's always something. You know, this world is really challenged at the moment. The whole situation in Syria, so much of the Middle East in turmoil, with violence. In Europe, things happening. In Pakistan, things happening. And if you add the personal dukkha, the suffering in our own lives, the lives of friends and families, again, it can seem overwhelming. It can really seem challenging. This is the first noble truth of dukkha. There is suffering. And yet, we also have to recognize so much that's positive or joyful. Even the fact that it's summer, I mean, it lifts the spirits to have beautiful evenings like this and to be able to practice in a place with such a lovely view just outside the door. You know, even just the abundance at the farmer's market and the fresh peaches and nectarines. I mean, there's so much in this world that is good and beautiful. All of the people, you might be including yourself, who are working for peace and justice and the environment, social causes. So much good happening, so many people practicing and wanting to wake up. So we always have to hold both, and that's really going to be the theme for this evening is how we do that. I led a class on Friday out at Spirit Rock for some senior students, a program that I'm leading. And the theme was a lot about concepts and how they get sticky and we they solidify around them. And so one of the questions I asked, well, what are some of the concepts you are holding? And it was amazing. There were two that were a repeated theme for people. Anyone want to guess? What are two things that you're thinking about a lot at the moment and polarizing about, getting engaged in? So one was Trump. They were very specific. Because we were talking about concepts and ideas, and the other was?
Race.
They were a little more mundane than that, I'm afraid, this group. The Olympics.
Oh, no.
It was Trump and the Olympics. A number of people said, this is what my mind is going to hear and do. Hope, you know, maybe one negatively, one positively, I don't know. But it was interesting just to see how many we have these things in the world. They're not, you know, directly affects, well, you know, the Olympics are happening a long way away, but the mind can really obsess around these kind of things, right? And the Olympics are such a good example of the human condition, both the enormous potential of a human being. I mean, mind-boggling, right? What some of these athletes can do, these women athletes, especially the young women gymnasts. It's incredible. And the sorrow. You know, you can win, especially this is in the swimming. I haven't watched that much, but the swimming. You know, you win by what? 1/100 of a second, and you're like, you're gold. And you're just silver, you know, second. Mm. And if you're fourth, right, you're not even on the radar, and yet you're fourth best in the world. And for someone who loses by that much, you know, the one who won by this sliver, like, that's golden. And yet that's what we do with concepts, with ideas, right? We make them so solid. We make them into gold and silver and bronze, and they divide up the world. So this is very representative of the human condition. In Buddhism, we call it samsara. And that you'll see lots of definitions of what this word might mean. In general, it means the human experience, the human realm, with all of its attendant joys and sorrows. But in Buddhist understanding, there is a sense of this kind of relentless nature of experience in it, of birth and death, and a lot around suffering. You know, there's repetition, that we're caught in this round of becoming that's underpinned by dukkha. First Noble Truth, there is dukkha in this realm. So this is what we live in, samsara. And I love this simple definition, or you could even say explanation of samsara. I think it was from a Tibetan teacher. And they said, samsara is unfixable. Mm-hmm. And why is it unfixable? Because its nature is the three characteristics. That's the nature of the conditioned realm: impermanent, unsatisfactory, unreliable, you could say, not in our control, anatta, anicca, dukkha, anatta. These are the three characteristics. So it's unfixable. And I actually had an experience of relief when I heard that, because what do we try to do with samsara? We try to fix it. Another definition I heard of samsara is the urge to correct. So you put those two together, something that's unfixable and the urge to fix or correct it, what do you get?
Suffering.
In many kinds of forms, right? And so just to sort of, this is what we do in our practice, is we step back and look at what we're doing here. Here's something that's inherently unfixable, and our ever-present urge is to fix it or correct it. This is a lot out of one of the fundamental causes of suffering, which, in Buddhism, is defined as ignorance or delusion. We have these basic misunderstandings of how things work, so we think we should be able to correct it. It should be fixable. And we live our lives in the stress of that, of feeling that we're not doing it right, or we haven't tried hard enough, or got our ducks in a row, whatever it is you think of in that way, because we don't understand the Dhamma. What's the Dhamma? The way things are. Reality, the truth, the law. The Buddha said something like, when he was in his enlightenment experience, saw beings, countless beings all over the world, wanting to be happy, yet doing everything that caused suffering. This is the basic dilemma of human existence, out of ignorance or delusion, not understanding the way things are. And so we perpetuate, again, this is samsara, in this perpetual struggle of trying to fix the unfixable, trying to correct what's inherently unreliable. Now, this is a big topic, as I had the thought of putting these two definitions together, and there's a lot of ways I could go with it. But what was interesting to me was the role of perception in this, because inherently there's a flaw in our perception of reality, because we think it's fixable. Again, we could see that as a perception, sanya in Buddhism. What the Buddha says is we have to recognize that our perceptions are often distorted. They're not actually a true reflection of reality. And so this one that I've been talking about is a big example of that. We think the world should be in our control and therefore fixable. And it should be able to be programmed in a way that we have only happiness and not suffering. And if we're having suffering, then something's wrong. And again, when you say it like that, it seems, no, I don't really think that. But we act subconsciously often as though that is the way we're seeing things. And when I'm talking about fixing here, it's fixing, and well, Philip loves this word, doesn't he? He talks about renouncing, comparing, fixing and judging, or something like that. Mm-hmm. Fixing in this sense is having a sense of black and white, right and wrong, you know, out there is a problem and I need to fix it. It's very different from acting out of wisdom and compassion to alleviate suffering. That's a very different action impetus which is inherently, you know, what we need to be doing. That's the role of us in waking up, is that we act to relieve suffering ourselves and others out of compassion and informed by wisdom. Fixing has this basically antagonistic attitude that something's wrong and I need to fix it. And it's very self-identified, self-obsessed. So to just separate, what I'm talking about is fixing, is that basic attitude. So around our perceptions, perception in Sanya, in its simplest definition, is the naming or recognizing of something out of memory. So clock and lamp and table. You know, if you took this into an Amazonian village where they, you know, hadn't had contact with many Western things, I don't know whether they would recognize that, right? We know what it is because, and it, even for us, it's a little strange there with its bendy neck and tiny, tiny light. You know, lamps used to be big and solid. And anyway, it's a concept. It's a sanya, perception. So we learn how to do this, to recognize things. But what we see, or the very role of meditation, is to help us clarify our perceptions. Because we've been trained, conditioned to believe that our thoughts and the way we perceive the world is the truth. That, well, whatever your view of this, you know, some people might love this thing. Oh, this is the best lamp ever. Look at it. It's bendy and you can put it here and there. But someone else might say it's a terrible lamp because I don't see a switch. How do I turn it on? It's, I presume it's down there, so there it is. But, you know, we don't have very different relationships to this, but we can very easily think that my experience of whatever this is the truth, right? The way things are. The work of meditation is to refine our understanding, and you could literally say our perceptions, so that they're closer to reality. And so we actually don't believe all our thoughts. That's a big one to start with. And you see that in meditation, right? They're basically out of control, and they feed us a lot of hoo-ha, right? You know, if we acted on all the thoughts that we had, we'd all be a little crazy, I think. And so mindfulness and clarity allows a choice point where we can see, oh, I'm having this belief or perception around something. Is this appropriate? Is it wise? Is it in alignment with, you know, my deeper understanding, my wiser voice, my intuition? Or is it being fed by delusion? So mindfulness creates a choice point, and this is, you know, again, what we practice for. So we have those moments where we're in our experience and we're able to see somewhat clearly, more clearly. There's a story about someone sort of being a bit challenging to a Zen master, where they were pushing him a little and said, so tell me, you know, what is the point of all this practice? What's the purpose of all of your lifetime of practice? And the Zen master just said, an appropriate response. And that seems a little wimpy, right? But to actually have the appropriate response for each situation is pretty amazing, I think. A little while ago, I happened to meet with one of our neighbors at Spirit Rock. Spirit Rock owns about 400 acres, and our neighbor next door actually has about 600 acres. And they run cows, so their fence line is our fence line. And every now and then the cows get through the fence and onto Spirit Rock land. And this neighbor, John, was telling me the story about realizing the fence was down and the cows had gotten through, and so coming onto the Spirit Rock property and looking for these cows. So they came across some people up on that high ridge trail up there and said, have you seen any cows? And these people, I think he did it to a couple of people, perhaps one at a time, just looked at him and walked on. And he was like, what the? You know, that's not an appropriate response. If you see someone and they ask you, have you seen any cows? You say yes or no, as the case may be. But an appropriate response isn't just to be in your meditative silence. It's not the context for that. Luckily he could laugh about it. He knew, you know, we're in meditation, but it just boggled my mind that people would hold to their silence, that they would not even say yes or no. No, I haven't seen any cows. But anyway. So an appropriate response and seeing, you know, can we clarify our experience in the moment? Our perceptions are deeply conditioned by our experience, by our upbringing, by our education, by all of the influences of society and culture. And again, part of our practice is being willing to recognize that and not always holding on to them as the truth and the way things are. I love this saying from the Talmud, the book of Jewish wisdom, where they say, we don't see things as they are, we see things as we are, meaning we see things through the lens of our perceptions and our conditioning. And what's tricky about perception is they usually have some basis in reality, right? Where, you know, there's some commonality which is necessary, you know, what you were talking before about volunteers to do this and that. You all have to agree on what that is, and that this is the table and that's the lamp, etc. But once you dive a little deeper, or if you certainly get into the realm of concepts, not so much physical objects, but even physical objects. You know, have you heard about the dress that broke the internet? It was a while ago now. I can still quite figure it out. But there was some image of a dress where some people saw it as black and gold and other people as green and silver or something, whatever. There was like millions of views of this and countless posts and arguments. Anyway, this is, and it's all just perception. So the Buddha recommended that we bring this functioning of the mind, of perception, and you could say concepts, because they lead to concepts or become concepts, into our meditation practice. One of the five aggregates, the list of five aspects of experience where the Buddha said we commonly cling and identify: form, feeling, perception, mental formations, and consciousness. We need to recognize when this aspect of experience is functioning and how it's conditioned and if it's distorted. Because it's through perception and our belief and solidifying of it that we create all the concepts in experience. And almost you could say that concept is another word for perception, but another way that we commonly distort our experience is through a process the Buddha called papancha. Anyone heard of papancha? Mm-hmm. Yeah. I love it. It sounds Italian. Papancha. And it has that kind of... Its experience is a bit like that. The common translation of it is mental proliferation. It has a literal meaning of something like diffusion. You could think of something, you know, kind of spreading out and encompassing and being tangled and complex and a web. This is the kind of literal definition of papancha, but it's a kind of thinking. There's many kinds of thinking. There's lots of thinking that's not problematic at all, just, you know, who's going to help with the setup and the put down, let's put the table here, and even more complex thinking. But papancha is usually considered problematic. And I used to think of it a little bit like daydream, you know, just when you'd be in reverie and ideas going here and there. But I've actually come to realize that what the Buddha was pointing to with this concept is more problematic than that, than just sort of mental daydreaming. Thanissaro Bhikkhu, who's a great Buddhist scholar and translator, he likes to translate papancha as objectification. And I think that's pointing to where the problem comes in. Another word could be conceptualization or reification, because what we're doing in this process of papancha is solidifying the concepts, solidifying the thoughts. So this cycle, feedback loop starts happening where we think something, We make it true, right or wrong, and then we react to that, right? And yes and no, and good and bad, and what about, and but they might disagree, but then I'd say this, and you know, whatever it might be. But a whole energetic feedback loop starts happening of emotions and reactivity. And this is where papancha becomes problematic. Because by this point, we're totally believing our thoughts. They're right, they're true, or maybe they're bad and wrong and terrible. We're imagining the end of the world. It's also papancha. But this roller coaster starts happening. And the main thing is we're lost in it. We're identified with it, we believe it, and we have no mindfulness. And out of this process, it said that papancha is the root cause of all the grief and strife in the world. It's said to be problematic in inner states and outer states, like greed, views, pride, ignorance, and attachment to becoming, again, concepts around self, to quarreling, slander, and lying, because out of papancha, you know, we exaggerate and we tell... Who do I think of when I tell lies about, you know, how things are? Basically, all forms of conflict come out of this holding on to, this solidification of this kind of thinking. And again, the problem is that we're lost in it. We don't question it. We're thinking it, therefore it's true. We're feeling it, therefore it's true. This is how mobs get created, right? This communal psychosis almost that can happen. And, oh, right, this is it. You know, let's get them. The other gets created. As soon as there's becoming, as soon as there's self, inherently there's the creation of other. And so the Buddha said no. He said, in whatever way you conceive, it is ever other than that. This is a really challenging statement. And that this kind of thinking leads us into all kinds of unwholesome and difficult mind states. And papancha is said to be intimately connected to craving, tanha, which is the cause of suffering, conceit, or mana, which is the judging, that Philip's judging, fixing, and comparing is helping us to lessen, and views, or ditti, where we again solidify this is right, that's wrong. Papancha is seen to underlie and be entwined with these three forms of dukkha, tanha, craving, conceit, and views or opinions. What's interesting is through our vipassana or mindfulness practice, as I say, as we develop more wisdom or insight or clarity, is that understanding the three characteristics of impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, or not self actually have the tendency to uproot the three qualities that papancha creates or is manifested in. So understanding or the perception of anicca or impermanence uproots mana or conceit, because we see we can't say, oh, this is, you know, look at me, I'm so great, because we see that it's an impermanent manifestation. That dukkha, understanding or the perception, the penetration into dukkha or suffering, uproots the tendency towards tanha, grasping. Because again, we see that grasping is actually the cause of suffering, not something that's going to bring us happiness. And that a penetration, a perception, an understanding of the characteristics of anatta, of no permanent or abiding self, or not being in control, uproots the tendency to holding on to views. Because again, we're not sort of putting the line in the sand, the stake in the ground, and saying, this is right, I'm right, this is how things are. We see that that's not really even possible to do that. So the three characteristics that I began talking about actually help us to begin to lessen our obsession with fixation on around papancha. Because if we don't understand this tendency of mind and what it does, its harmful impact, we will be beguiled by it again and again and again. As I said, there's a roller coaster that gets happening with it that is very seductive. And we get pulled into it and end up in these basic forms of craving. I want it should be this way, this is how it is, this is right, this is true, this is good. Or all of the states of aversion. This is bad, I don't want, this is wrong, out there is wrong, or I'm wrong. All of the forms of comparing and judging. As I said, conceit. So this is what happens if we don't understand the power and the problem around papancha. It has an addictive nature. Really, we can feel it. It's like, yes, we bite into it. We hold on to it. We land in it, and we let it feed itself, so it has a life of its own. Again, mindfulness is our best ally. Really to feel this energy, because it comes with an energy. Some of you are nodding. I think you know that, yes, right, you're in your own internal world and you're making this fantasy world where you're going to be in control and it's going to happen this way and you're going to get people to do that and then this is going to happen or we're going to get it like this. And we can feel the energy that arises out of that. If you get used to it, again, it's another thing we can be mindful of, just like the hindrances, just like any kind of thinking. You know, we often give in retreats the guidance on working with thoughts. Again, not to make thoughts bad or wrong. It's this particular kind of thinking that's problematic for us. But we can recognize, oh, this is papancha. And especially if you know there's a story you tell yourself over and over again. You know, Thanksgiving. It's a bit far away, but it's the first one that came to me. You know, there's just so much that comes with that, right? And you start the planning or the not wanting or the, you know, making it great or the hating it. And there you are in whatever world you create out of that. You can be aware of that. And as I said, there's a pleasantness in it or we wouldn't do it. There's the illusion of control in papancha. As we create this fantasy world, we're in, you know, we're king and queen in the world, right? You know, we're creating the rules and writing the scenarios, but it's an illusion. It's totally an illusion, totally mind-made. So to really see how many of these obsessive kind of thoughts come out of the needing to control. I heard this story, I don't know if it's true, it's probably just a joke, where a young woman had gone off to college and she was coming home for summer break and she told her mother what time she was going to drive home, you know, these many hours from college for summer, told her mother what time she was going to arrive home, but she managed to get off a little early, so she arrived 3 hours earlier than she had told her mother. And when the mother opened the door, she was horrified. And the daughter was like, I thought you'd be happy to see me early. She said, but no, it meant you were driving for 3 hours without me worrying about you. And don't we have this idea that the worry actually, you know, has some energetic effect? But if you really pay attention, it's suffering. So this is our clue. To see, feel the fear and the agitation, the contraction that comes when we're in this mindset, it can feel very physical. And see how it comes out of a lack of trust of ourselves, of the situation, of our capacity to meet the situation. James Barras will often say, trust that mindfulness can meet any moment. That if we're actually in the moment, with what's happening, we'll do what we need to do. Our anticipation and planning and worry and fantasy is not actually helping us in that momentary presence. And another teacher, Brian Lesage, I was with, teaching with, when he talked about this movement of mind and letting go, of, especially when it's around views and opinions, he'll ask himself this question, do I want to be right or do I want to be free? And you really have to see that these two cannot usually coincide. You know, the urge to be right, to be, you know, in control or believed or whatever, doesn't support a freedom of heart and mind. So do I want to be right or do I want to be free? We can get so lost in this idea of right and wrong. I heard some great relationship advice a while ago, and it's very simple. And the relationship advice is, whoever is doing it, as in any task, household kind of thing, whoever is doing it right. So loading the dishwasher, the laundry, you know, cleaning anything, making a shopping list, whoever is doing, it's been very helpful to me. So a lot of it is, as I said, just mindfulness is our greatest ally. Feel, get to know the energy around this kind of thinking. It's up, usually some kind of uprising, right? Our heartbeat raises a little. You know, they're doing these, all these MRIs, functional MRIs, around mind states, and they say just thinking about something gets all of the same mental and energetic systems going as actually doing it, right? It has the same stress effect or uplifting effect on the body. So feel that. You know, the heart pounding, tightness, tingling. For me, it's, you know, usually a little tension here or the set of the jaw, how your shoulders are. We can know this for ourselves through our mindfulness. That for me is, it's the same whether I'm looking for papancha or a sense of self or views and opinions. It's all the same kind of energy. So we can begin to recognize that for ourselves, what that actually feels like. We can bring this into our mindfulness because it's a source of suffering. It's a manifestation of delusion, and that's the very heart of our practice. But again, need to do it with compassion. It's not like you need to bring the big mindfulness stick out, oh, there you go again, papancha, you know, look at that same thought 100 times. Really a lot of compassion. This is a deeply ingrained pattern. Bring some humor into it. I mean, if you really step back and look at your mind fantasies, if you actually had to tell someone how you were arranging the world and really be honest, you have to have some humor about it. And it has a lot of energy to it, so it's understandable that we get caught over and over again. But the more we begin to bring mindfulness to it, and particularly to notice that in and of itself it's dukkha. You know, as I said, there's some pleasantness in it, otherwise we wouldn't do it. Some gnawing at it, the worrying that helps us think that we're controlling things, a sense of right and wrong. But feel into that, really, especially once we've touched into a mind and heart that's more peaceful or has more equanimity, and you feel the contrast. Like my teacher Ajahn Sumedho will say about anything, you have to know papancha to know non-papancha. So we know it and feel it, not say, oh, bad, wrong, papancha. Oh, that's what it feels like when I get on that horse where I ride that energy. Feel it in your body, feel it in your heart. And we start to really challenge this way of thinking. Papancha, conceptualization, and views and opinions, and recognize that we're not always right. That there is a subjectivity and a conditioned nature to these experiences. And there's a whole teaching, which I knew I wouldn't have time to get into tonight, on the kind of causal progression of papancha. If you know the teaching on dependent origination with its different links, papancha has the same kind of process with, you know, very simple experience leading to very simple thinking to more complex thinking to, boom, landing of papancha. And then what happens after that? We can actually start to unwind that and see what's actually happening in our experience. And all of this is not to deny the validity or the richness of our inner life of emotions or our creative thinking processes. But this particular kind of thinking, as I said, where we get solidified around it, and it's the root cause of so much sense of separation and hostility and ill will in ourselves and the world. And as I said again earlier, using our mindfulness to recognize this and create this choice point. Do I want to continue to go down that road, to keep fueling that kind of thinking, or actually settle back and let go, let be, not actually, you know, have to ride it out until we're just exhausted and frustrated and confused. And so the experience of meditation, of the quietness of the mind that we can cultivate, is a clear contrast to this kind of thinking that I'm talking about. And what's interesting, again, could talk a lot more about this, but as I said, the Buddha taught that understanding and working skillfully with papancha is key if we want to deepen in practice and become more free. That actually nipapancha, nip meaning not papancha, is the mind of an arhat. Or the, you could say the other way, a mind of an arhat, which is an enlightened being, is characterized by nipapancha, not having papancha. So can see the power of this kind of thinking when we're obsessed or lost in it. We're the opposite of free. But a mind that's free of papancha is an awakened mind. This is a direct or clear pointing to the necessity of understanding this tendency and bringing more mindfulness to it and beginning to lessen our obsession with it. And so again, we come back to mindfulness, breath and body, feeling the contraction, feeling the surge of energy, feeling the, you know, the sword of justice that you start to wield. It's amazing how tantalizing self-righteous indignation is, right? It's an addiction. It fuels so many political movements. And it gets beyond indignation into, you know, all kinds of obsessions. Know that energy, so come back. The Brahmaviharas are great supports. The Brahmaviharas, these four beautiful qualities of mind and heart that we can cultivate, metta or loving kindness, compassion, karuna, mudita, joy, equanimity especially. Equanimity leads to insight. So all of these have their role in us understanding the tendency into this mind state and what it's like to unwind it a little. I actually think that one of the beautiful antidotes to papancha is gratitude practice. Because papancha is always saying, I've got to make things different. This is where I got, coming back to where I began, of samsara, wanting to fix or correct. This is the movement of papancha. It's like there's some ideal out there, and in my imagining, I'm going to make it so. Because it's bad or wrong as it is right now, and it's got to be fixed. Gratitude practice says the opposite. It says, I have blessings here and now in my life, and actually opening to them will bring joy and happiness. Many of you probably know the work of Robert Emmons. I think he's over in Berkeley, right? He's the guru of gratitude, just always talking about the blessings of gratitude and encouraging people to do an active gratitude practice, whether it's a gratitude journal, or having a gratitude buddy, or remembering what you're grateful for. And he says, gratitude has two components. First, it's an affirmation of goodness. We affirm that there are good things in the world, gifts and benefits we've received. This doesn't mean that life is perfect. It doesn't ignore complaints, burdens, and hassles. But when we look at life as a whole, gratitude encourages us to identify some amount of goodness in our life. The second part of gratitude is figuring out where that goodness comes from. We recognize the sources of this goodness as being outside of ourselves. Instead of outside being bad and wrong and I've got to fix it. That's me saying that. It doesn't stem from anything we necessarily did ourselves in which we might take pride. We can appreciate positive traits in ourselves, but I think true gratitude involves a humble dependence on others. We acknowledge that other people or even higher powers, if you're of a spiritual mindset, gave us many gifts, big and small, to help us achieve the goodness we have in our lives, the goodness in our lives. So this is a direct counterbalance to this movement of papancha, which always comes out of some sense of deficiency and right and wrong, the urge to correct, trying to fix, gratitude. And he goes on all the benefits of gratitude, you know, physical, stronger immune system, lower blood pressure, exercise. We exercise more, take better care, we sleep longer, feel more full, we feel more alert, refreshed. It sounds like the aid to all our ills is just being grateful. We're more social, we're more helpful and generous and compassionate, more forgiving, more outgoing, less lonely, isolated. Gratitude is a great counterbalance to this tendency of mind and the urge to fix. And I love that the Dalai Lama always comes back to my religion is kindness and the purpose of a human life is to be happy. Not to try and fix the world, because that's impossible, but to actually find a way of being in the world. Again, I'm not that's apathetic and not engaged and doing what we can to lessen suffering in the world, all of the activism that's so needed and beneficial, but this antagonistic attitude that can be so problematic. And as I was thinking about this, I was reminded of a dear friend of mine who died a few years ago now, and she was just such a special being, a deep Dharma practitioner and an inspiration to me, and I thought, what was so special about this woman? And I just thought of four core values that I saw that she had, that she really tried to cultivate in her life. And one was well-being, as in a sense of health, even though she had many health challenges. Sense of peace. She was a meditator and did a lot of practice. Happiness and loving relationships. And I just thought, they're really core values that all of us need to keep an eye on. Well-being. So whatever that means for you, however you take care of yourself, we all have limitations, but that we have a sense of engagement with that. We're actually honoring this body and doing what we can, not meaning that we'll be in perfect health, that's not possible, but just a sense of well-being. Peace, that we cultivate equanimity and calm and meditation. Happiness, that it's possible through practices of the Brahmaviharas, of gratitude, of meditation, to develop, not, this is not a giddy kind of happiness, but a sense of contentment and the confidence that we can deal with life as it presents itself. This is what happiness means. And then loving relationships, friendships, family, that there's a sense of metta in our social world of Kalyanamita, spiritual friends. All of these, many different practices, all important, directly counterbalance that tendency, urge to fix, to correct what's unfixable. But it doesn't mean that there isn't goodness and beauty and love in the world, because there is. And so this is where we live. This is samsara. The 10,000 joys and the 10,000 sorrows. But we, even though the First Noble Truth says that there is suffering in life, the Buddha taught for the end of suffering, for happiness and well-being. And so they're the values that we can actually clearly recognize, cultivate, and practice. So, I'm curious, in your life, what are the areas where you find yourself again trying to fix, trying to correct? What is it?
Well, it's not, I'm not sure it's fixing or correcting, but I play the conversation that hasn't happened yet.
Uh-huh.
And I know I'm playing it.
Mm.
And I say, And then I play it.
Again, yeah.
Over
yeah.
and over. I'm playing a conversation I'm going to have with my daughter.
Yeah.
And
is
she
it
may
a,
surprise me.
Is it a difficult conversation?
Oh, of course.
Yes. So that's important.
I don't have
yes, any. Exactly.
Easy conversations are easy. Yes, and I know I'm doing
mm-hmm.
it. And I'm mindful of doing it. I'm doing it.
But again, you said don't know, not know whether it's fixing correctly. I mean, it is in the sense of trying to control.
Oh,
trying
absolutely.
To make that conversation come out the way you want. That's the fixing part.
Well,
of trying
it's
to,
also, for me, I think it's preparing myself.
Yes.
How am I going to respond? So I've already put
took her words in.
I've already put her in a negative position.
But you know, this is what we have to see, and obviously you haven't done it till you've suffered enough around it. That's when you stop doing it.
No, she has.
She has. Well, so there we can learn from that. But you know what, a big help for me around papancha, and it was particularly around end of retreat papancha, especially I've done a lot of long retreats where the mind can really get going about what's going to happen, what it's like, what you want to do. I started keeping track, and you may have heard me say this before if you've ever heard me talk about this, about how true or how real, whether they played out the way I thought they were going to.
Mm.
And so you, what do you think? And it was many varied things, just sense desire and you know, things that might have happened and relationships and whatever. It was many range of things. How many came true the way I thought they were going
Zero.
To?
Zero.
Zero. And just, I just, you know, in meditation really got that. And I saw even that my papancha of that kind was almost like a curse. If I imagined it, it would not come true the way that I thought it would. So it was like you were actually undercutting what I actually wanted to happen. So I just had to reflect on not so much the content, but the actual experience, you know, the bigger picture of what was happening and how it actually really undercut my capacity to be in that experience when it was actually happening. So I just need to continually do a lot of reflection on that in a space where I could actually let that in. Because if I'm really just playing it out, I'm in that agitation. So somehow, you know, to actually quiet the mind a little and get a little curious about what's underneath. And, you know, I'm sure you know it's fear, it's agitation, it's wanting to... But something's deeper going on there that somehow needs to be seen. What other fixations? That's a good fixations. Do you have? And what helps you? What supports you if you know that you do it? Yes.
So I just want to say thank you so very, 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 very much. I said poetry day today.
Oh, with Philip. Yes.
And I thought I had taken in about everything I could take in, but I really wanted to hear you. And this is so perfect because I have been completely ruminating for the past 3 weeks now about a particular situation, and I believe there's going to be a conversation.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Say,
mm-hmm. They could do a mutual support group here.
I have phrased and rephrased and tried to be skillful and mindful and even... knowing I'm ruminating, this is suffering, it's giving me a headache, I'm going to put it down, I'm going to be free. I think the gratitude thing, I think I'm going to do that.
Yeah,
now.
Yeah. Because sometimes we need a clear intervention. You know, one of the things that's often helpful is just the not now. I'm just, you know, you need to be a little fierce sometimes because there is a hook. And it's obviously some sense of fear that's wanting it to work out okay, you know, say the right thing, whatever it is. So if we can get to the root cause, but sometimes we just need to say not now or, you know, I have to say it's like, your two-year-old's got the cell phone and you dangle your keys and say, play with this instead, you know, so whatever that is, whether it's...
I need to question my motivation and my intention
yeah.
as well. You know, what are you holding on to?
Mm-hmm.
What's your goal? What's your purpose?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've just employed, but maybe not enough.
Yeah.
I'm going to try gratitude.
Gratitude,
now.
Yeah,
so
is a great intervention.
So
and, you know, there's tons of stuff online about doing that as a practice and the benefits of it. I mean, it's like a miracle cure if you believe what Robert Emmons said. But it's very inspiring, and I think it's real. It's beautiful. What else? Fixations and perhaps what supports you or might support you in your fixations. Yeah.
The line around what I can and can't control,
right,
realistically.
Yes.
I have a lot of trouble with that.
Yes.
Because often, especially these days, with more information, you actually can do things that you didn't think were possible.
Mm-hmm.
And that's great,
mm-hmm,
but it's not great if you spin off into the weeds because you can't ever put it down.
Yes, yeah. And that's always the big question, is what's the line? You know, because there are definitely places we engaged and we can make a difference and, you know, prepare ourselves in a way that's helpful, and then what's too much? But that's, again, the mindfulness of really being willing to track. And as we get more sensitive, the energy, and as I said, papancha thinking has a kind of energy to it. We can get familiar to it, just as people have been saying. And it's not like mindfulness is just this magic button that it's going to clearly say yes, no, this, that. But as we get more attuned and more sensitive, that is the whole purpose of practice, is refining where that line is. And, of course, it's not a solid line, you know, written in stone. It's a movable place. But we get more interested in our own immediate well-being than the tantalizing myth of the control of some future event. And, again, part of what I really see for myself is just having the trust that in the moment I'll do what I need to do. You know, again, there's some planning that's always necessary to get things to happen, but to tell more and more where it is. You know, I have one teacher, Sonny Rinpoche, said, if you've thought the same thought 5 times, cut it out. You know, that's too much. 5 times, that's enough. And, you know, maybe, oh, it's slightly different, though. I added a word, you know. You know, really just to feel the energy of it. But just to even be curious about that. I mean, as we have these conversations, as we reflect for ourselves, we're not in delusion about what's happening as much as we were if we just completely bought into, I'm going to control this by thinking about it. So, you know, this is why we talk with each other and practice and read the teachings. A door opens a little on what the process is, and that's what clarity and wisdom is. And it, you know, we don't just land there and great, figured that one out. We're, you know, always in that figuring out process, but we start to know for ourselves when it just, you know, we're just exhausting ourselves, right? We're just depleting energy rather than actually being constructive. That's, yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. Yes.
With all of our teachings, I will go into situations with people and say, well, if you only followed what I know. And it's really hard sometimes because, like, our son is going through all sorts of problems with his kids and stuff. And I can't give him advice.
No.
Because he can't listen.
No.
Yeah,
and that's a bit, you know, it's one of the hardest things, especially as a parent. Every parent wants their child not to suffer and not make the same mistakes. And that's not possible. That's samsara. Trying to fix what's unfixable, trying to correct what's uncorrectable. And again, doesn't mean you're a good parent or give advice when it's asked, but this is where I began. This is our conundrum. And if we think that if we did it better, if we were a better parent, or he was a better son and would listen, it would all be okay, that's a fantasy. And, you know, it's hard for us to accept that, but that's the truth. And again, not to say that's a call to apathy. We engage and we love and we connect, but we have to realize the limits of that. I think we need to, we're at 5:02 and have announcements and your metta practice, so... Thank you again for your interest and presence this evening. I hope it was helpful. Thank you. Thanks.
One meta card here. For Axel, as he comes out of detox and continues his transition. And for Howard, who struggles with Parkinson's disease.
Hmm. Oh, that was it? last time I see you, there was many. So may that mean that things are well in life for many people.
Too busy with the Olympics.
Yes. So just taking a moment again to mindfully feel the body sitting, breathing. And whatever mood or emotion, thoughts might be present. And in this practice process, we don't make anything bad or wrong. Try to get rid of anything or make anything stay. Just the willingness to be present and know what's happening right here. And we might take a moment to reflect on the blessings in our life, that we've encountered the Dhamma and practice, that we have these good friends in the Sangha who support us, that we have a place to live and food to eat, and we're relatively safe in our lives. Many people don't have that at all. Perhaps there are particular blessings that you can be grateful for yourself or loved ones. And recognize that you are not the owner of these blessings. You didn't create them. They were given to you. And as the heart opens, can appreciate the goodness and the blessings. We have this interconnectedness with all the beings around us, friends, family, colleagues, people in our communities. We open our hearts to them and wish them well. They are friends, our families, our loved ones. Be well, happy, and peaceful. May they experience gratitude, well-being, and peace in their lives. And we can dedicate the blessings of our life, the merit of our practice, that it supports ourselves, of course, but also these dear ones, friends, family, colleagues, loved ones, and also wider to all beings everywhere in states of happiness and unhappiness, human and non-human. We truly wish that all beings find ease and peace in their lives, are protected and safe, know contentment and well-being, and come to the end of suffering. Thank you for your interest, your practice, and the people who support this group continuing. I know there are many who are very central. It's one of the wonderful things to do is to actually support Dhamma practice happening. So I invite you to also do that. And I'll see you again. Okay.